You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done, and by union what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome again to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the Kansas City Federation of Teachers, Local 691, and Millwrights, Local 1529. The KCFT SRP represents the classified and certified members of Kansas City Public Schools. KCFT SRP members believe that strong schools mean strong communities. We work hard every day to give KC kids the support they need and the quality education they deserve. And Millwrights Local 1529 has supported labor and working class families for over 100 years. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Max Alvarez of The Real News has a new book, The Work of Living. In it, he dives deep into the lives of essential workers and how they survived being essential. He'll be on the show tonight. And then, in 1969, an NLRB lawyer's mistake undid 20 years of labor-friendly law on card check and union recognition. Today's NLRB general counsel is working to fix that. We'll talk about it with Ian Ward of Politico. In the news, COVID isn't Biden's only worry. Imagine what a nationwide rail strike could do for supply chain problems. And are dollar stores' claims of low prices a scam? Yes, says More Perfect Union. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Michael Amish. And now for the news.
The news from our side, July 21st, 2022. United Rail Unions, a coalition of a dozen unions representing about 115,000 railroad workers represented by SMART, the Teamsters and IBEW and machinists, Boilermakers, TCU and others who are part of the Coordinated Bargaining Coalition, attended the public interest hearings hosted by the members of the National Mediation Board on Tuesday, July 12th, 2022. They issued a statement of July 15th thanking the NMB for their efforts to help them help their parties reach a voluntary labor agreement with rail carriers. Unfortunately, they say, the nation's rail carriers continue to refuse to negotiate an agreement that our members would accept. As a result, and as was expected, President Biden announced that he would appoint a presidential emergency board before the expiration of the cooling off period at 12 a.m. on Monday, July 18, 2022. The presidential emergency board will have 30 days to convene, hear the positions of the unions and rail carriers, and issue recommendations for settlement of the dispute. A second 30-day cooling-off period will begin with those recommendations when those recommendations are issued. After that, around September 18th, if there is no settlement, the unions would be free to strike, and whether to stop a strike would end up in the rather dysfunctional U.S. Congress right before the November elections. The rail unions remain united in their efforts and are now working together in preparation to present a unified case to the Presidential Emergency Board, backed up by current economic data and showing workers' contribution to the record profits of the rail carriers. In the past, divisions among the rail unions have led to years of weak contracts, so the unity shown in this round of negotiations is very historic. Dennis Pierce, president of the Engineers and Trainmen Union, said, "These are the employees that worked every day during a pandemic and helped these folks make record profits. Rail workers haven't had a raise in 3 years despite record inflation. As employment decreased by over 20,000 workers, employees are forced to be on call 24/7. Pierce said, "The employees are angry. It's a level of frustration amongst the workforce unlike any I have seen in the 45 years I've worked at the railroad. There hasn't been a freight rail strike in the U.S. since 1992.
Robert E. Eisler Jr., known to everyone as Bob, died on July 4th. He was almost 98 years old. Born and raised in Kansas City, where as a teen he threw papers for the Kansas City Star on his bicycle. He served in the Army Signal Corps in Burma from 1943 to 1946 during World War II as a communications liaison between the Chinese and U.S. forces. After the war, he was a pin setter in a bowling alley. He ended up organizing pin setters into the Window Washers Union that his father had founded. Bob became secretary treasurer and business representative for Service Employees International Union Local 96, where he worked for 28 years. SEIU Local 96 is now part of Local 1. Because of the rising cost of health care insurance, Bob and a few doctors and employers formed Prime Health, the first health maintenance organization in the Midwest, where he became the health services director. After the sale of Prime Health to Humana, he became vice president of operations and held that role until his retirement in December 1992. Bob was a real expert on health insurance and advised many unions on health care bargaining.
Here's a few snippets from Mike Elk's Payday Report, which you can find online at paydayreport.com. The first Comic-Con live in-person event since COVID is scheduled this weekend in San Diego. It's big news. But what isn't is that workers at the Hilton San Diego Bayfront, where Comic-Con is being hosted, just went on strike. The workers are insisting on a $4 an hour raise. Bridget Browning, president of Unite Here Local 30, told Mike Elk, "We can't allow hotel workers to continue suffering in a billion-dollar industry. These workers are ready to fight for what they deserve." And also from the Payday Report, last month, workers at a Chipotle location in Augusta, Maine, launched the company's first ever union. Now the company is closing that location permanently, claiming that they are unable to staff the location. Chipotle United denounced the move as union busting. This is Union Busting 101, and there's nothing that motivates us to fight harder than this underhanded attempt to shut down the labor movement within their stores, Chipotle United organizer Brandy McNeese said in a statement. They're scared because they know how powerful we are, and if we catch fire like the unionization effort at Starbucks, they won't be able to stop us.
A new expose from More Perfect Union finds that Dollar General, a titan of American retail, says its brand stands for low prices. True, the chain pays its workers industry-low wages in understaffed stores that can be magnets for armed burglary. And yes, dollar store management targets economically struggling communities, focusing on customers who make less than $40,000 a year and visit the store multiple times a week. "The economy is continuing to create more of our core customer," CEO Todd Vazos said in 2018. But to those working class consumers, Dollar General promises to deliver everyday low prices. In reality, without knowing it, customers are often paying Whole Foods prices for dollar store groceries. The investigation by More Perfect Union reveals that Dollar General charges premium prices across a range of staple goods, 52% more per pound for chicken breasts than its cheapest competitor, for instance, but masks the high costs from consumers by stocking smaller pack sizes. In other words, Dollar General often charges more for less. And that strategy is a primary driver of the company's ability to achieve gross margins significantly above the industry average, enriching shareholders often at the expense of customers. Find the whole report at More Perfect Union. The news from our side was read tonight by Judy Ansel, Brian Wilson, and I'm Stephen Hill.
Is our home, but for now we'll let it be. The battle is not over, and our struggle has begun. A new hope has been born, and a sunny day will come. Look up in the sky. In the trees, atop a floating cloud that echoes to be free. In time, I will give back the life that you took away, and your land to make believe will be ours again someday.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Chris Mann, and I'll be hosting the first segment of our show tonight. The introductory music you've heard was Plight of the Red Man by Exit. Exit stands for Crossing of Indian Tribes. Their initial recording, 1972's Plight of the Red Man, is about the changes in Native American life since the arrival of Columbus. Dwayne Chili Yazzie, he's a Native American, he was in our guest book tonight. He was a member of this band and spoke about how the earth is rebelling against mistreatment by mankind. Tonight, our topic covers essential workers and the effects of the pandemic. Our guest is Maximilian Alvarez. Max conducted a series of 10 interviews with workers of all stripes, a sheet metal worker, a burlesque performer, producer, a grave digger, a nurse, a silver miner, a bartender, a gig worker. Max spoke with them about their lives, their work, and their experiences living through a year when the world itself seemed to break apart. Max also is a widely celebrated podcast, has a podcast called Working People, and is the editor of Real News. Cooper Caraway, president of South Dakota Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, says about Max's writing, he says, his writing not only gives voice to the voiceless, but paints their dreams and aspirations in a clear and vivid way, leaving the reader reborn and baptized in historic global struggle for solidarity and justice. Welcome, Max, to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you so much for having me on. Huge, huge fan of the show.
Oh my gosh, and we're a huge fan of yours also. Can you tell our listeners to start out? I want to throw you just four little questions here that can go real fast. Tell our listeners a little bit about your background. Why was it important for you to write this book? How did you pick the people in the book to write about? And why did you choose the title? The title is The Work of Living. Working people talk about their lives in the year the world broke.
Well, if there's anything that people know about me, it's that I am not fast with my answers. So I will do the opposite of what I normally do here. I promise. Don't worry. So I really appreciate you having me on to talk about the book. I guess I'll work kind of backwards with those questions, starting with the title. As you said, the book is called The Work of Living. Working people talk about their lives in the year the world broke. That subtitle may sound somewhat familiar to folks, and it's very much an ode to the great Studs Terkel, who uses a similar subtitle to his book, Working, which I cite in the introduction to the very first episode of Working People that I ever recorded, right? Because I feel like all of us, including y'all at the Heartland Labor Forum, right? I think one of the beautiful things about Studs Terkel's legacy is there is no one inheritor to it. There are many of us doing that work and carrying that torch on to lift up the lives and voices and struggles and honor the humanity of our fellow workers. And so I wanted to pay homage to Studs with that subtitle. The title itself, you know, I wanted to convey a notion that, this kind of wraps into the question about how I chose folks, right? I remember when I was approached by Orr Books, by the great Teddy Ostro, my editor, who I'm very grateful to for approaching me about doing this book. And I think he approached me after I put together nearly 6 hours of testimonies from workers about 2 to 3 months into the pandemic in 2020. I put out a call on social media asking folks, send in your stories and tell me what you're going through right now. And the response was really overwhelming. And I think that if you go back and listen to those episodes, you really are thrust back into that moment of terror and disarray and abandonment that we were all in. And it was in that moment of institutional abandonment by our employers and the quote unquote free market. It was then that, you know, working people has always showed their mettle, right? It was us who kept us together. It was working people who kept the world from falling apart. It was working people who sacrificed to keep the gears of commerce and society turning. And it wasn't just the quote unquote essential workers who were dubbed essential by, you know, the government or by their employers. What I wanted to convey in the title of this book and in the people that I chose to talk to for it was that there were so many forms of essential work being done to keep society afloat during COVID-19 and any other time that we don't recognize as such. And I hope that came through. I wanted, you know, the people taking care of kids at home, the people checking on their immunocompromised neighbors and elders, the people delivering food to people who couldn't venture outside or were afraid to venture outside. You know, I wanted to really communicate that working people are essential, right? And we all do essential labor that, as we saw during COVID-19, really holds the world up.
Awesome. I want to take a minute to compliment you on your interviewing and listening skills. As I read the book, you did connect with all of the people's humanness, and you also meandered into the significant parts of their lives, and then you tried to find commonality. And Sarah Nelson from the International President of the Association of Flight Attendants, she said it better. She said, Alvarez doesn't just report. He listens like an organizer and pulls fundamental challenges of humanity from the people he interviews so that it's never just about storytelling or setting a narrative. It's about finding what really binds us together in those struggles so that we can fight our way forward with real love and solidarity. I want to go now to, could you tell us about two of the people that you interviewed in the book, The Work of Living, that touched you the most, and explain why you felt that way?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And thank you for the kind words. I really appreciate it. And of course, I'm beyond honored to have the great Cooper Caraway and Sarah Nelson have blurbs on my book. That really is a dream come true for me. I love and respect them tremendously. And, you know, it's very hard, right, to kind of pick out two interviews, you know, in this book that, you know, like you said, like have real special meaning to me or that struck me in a special way, because every single one of them, you know, and every single one of these people that I spoke to and who, you know, gave so much of themselves in these conversations, I'm really grateful to all of them. But I would say, like, you know, upon reflection, I think that, you know, the first interview in the book with Nick Galupo, who is a grave digger in New Jersey, you know, that was one of the first interviews that I recorded for the book. And it really set the tone, I think, for the whole project. And I'm grateful to the amazing journalist Lauren Gurley, actually, for helping me connect with Nick, because I had seen a report that she did on gravediggers during COVID. And I told her about the book and she was great. She was kind enough to help me connect with Nick. And, you know, if you read that interview, I think it's very humanizing, right? You really, like, we have so many sort of depictions of graveyards and so many kind of preconceptions of what goes on there. Like, it's kind of, I think Nick describes it as like the society's best kept secret, right? Everyone knows that's where we all end up, but none of us really want to think about what goes on there. And we only want to go there at very specific times to pay our respects or to bury a loved one. It's people like Nick who keep that stuff running and who really, you know, you hear in Nick's story, right, how seriously he takes that responsibility to provide that comfort for families who are sending their loved ones off into the great beyond, providing that sort of, yeah, like respectable send off for people who are leaving this mortal coil. He really takes that seriously, and he takes his job seriously because of that. But at the same time, you know, we that all unfolds over the course of Nick talking about his own life, how he got into working at the graveyard, why he stayed even when he was presented with the opportunity for a better paying job that wasn't so morbid, right? You know, there was something that kept him there. And, you know, he really felt that that sense of duty that he has working at the graveyard during COVID-19, when the number of people buried per day basically tripled overnight. And the scenes that Nick paints of working in those first few months of COVID are really harrowing. And I think, yeah, it really, really puts you in, you know, the mind frame of what he and his coworkers were going through at that horrific time. But it just really struck me, you know, like, you know, COVID-19, of course, has forced us to confront our own mortality in a way that maybe we didn't have to before, right? All of us at the same time had to confront the reality that we're all going to die as we were losing, you know, millions and millions of people around the world. That really does something to you, right? And I think, you know, reading Nick's and talking to Nick about death and about his understanding of death and peace and what it means to live a fulfilling life, you know, really, I think, centered me at a time when I was feeling very adrift during the end of the first year of COVID-19. So I would say that interview with Nick really stands out to me. And, you know, I think that I was most emotionally kind of hit by my interview with Courtney Smith. And, you know, I think we just really connected on a deep level, and we could have talked for hours and hours more. But we really, like you said, took a meandering path through her life growing up, you know, as a kid in a very kind of in a mixed race, poor household. And, you know, just kind of all the sort of struggles of growing up as a mixed race, poor person in the United States. So like that generated a whole lot of fodder for discussion. It made us, you know, kind of talk about memories that we hadn't thought about in a long time. And then by the time we get to COVID, you know, there was already so much that we had revealed to each other in so many ways that we had connected to each other, like really intense stories about losing her brother to suicide, right? And how she got into political organizing and how she lost her dream job because she had a conviction on her criminal record, even though she had done everything she could to improve her life and her son's life. It was just, I think, it was what I had hoped this book would be and communicate to people, which is just that everyone who is working, you know, in this country and beyond is such a deep, complex feeling human being who has such an incredible story to tell. And we live in a society that does not recognize that or honor that. And that, I think, is a real crime.
Yes. And Courtney was very interesting because I have a quote from her from the book. She says, "Capitalism is still a barrier. Now I now know it's not all of my fault." What she's saying is everything that happened to her, she realizes is not her fault. It's the structure.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and just to like even contextualize that more for listeners is I think she mentioned that after we talked about her struggle with addiction, right? And alcoholism, right? And she talks very openly, yeah, about how she, you know, again, growing up poor, her father, who was dealing with a lot of his own trauma and being Black in the United States and poor, was, you know, in and out of prison. And that really left her, Courtney, and her siblings like to kind of fend for themselves a lot of times while their mom struggled to keep a roof over their heads. And she ended up, I think she says, having like her first drink by the time she was 12 or 13 or something like that. And she really fell into a, you know, a kind of dark hole for a number of years. And with truly with a true show of, I think, like heroism, right, she pulled herself out of that. She made a life for herself and her son and her students and then got into organizing after that. But yeah, like that was a point where we kind of both started tearing up, where it meant a whole lot for her to say after going through all that and being told by society, being told by friends and family and others, right, that it was just her fault, it was just her problem to fix, right? The more that she gained that understanding of how society and our economy is rigged against working people helped her to understand, well, actually there were a lot of things that other people get that I didn't, right? Other opportunities that I didn't. That's not to say that she blamed everything on those, but it made her realize that she didn't have to just punish herself endlessly for succumbing to alcoholism, right? There are larger structural forces at work, and she has committed herself politically to addressing those structural problems that create similar situations for people like her growing up in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we only have about 3 minutes left. So I wondered if you can sort of generalize how the pandemic affected all of the workers you interviewed. I mean, just a common thread, a common couple of threads that played out for all workers during this time.
Yeah. I mean, like I would say, and, you know, really, I think there's one point that really stands out to me, right? Because I know we only got like a minute here. I think the most common thread that binds all of these stories together, and that I think a lot of us can really identify with, and I've seen this in the interviews that I've done with workers at the Real News Network and on my show Working People as well, not just in this book, but the pandemic made it clearer than ever that we live and labor in a system that values our labor as essential, but not our lives. It considers our lives as expendable, right? And I think that it has been a radicalizing force for a lot of working people who have both understood how essential they and their labor are to keeping businesses running, keeping society going, so on and so forth, at the same time that they are treated as disposable things whose lives and families don't matter to their employers. And I think that's why, in part, we're seeing more folks unionizing, more folks quitting, more folks really getting militant and striking. And I hope that continues.
Well, Max, I think we're about out of time, but you summed that up beautifully. That was a combination of two or three of my lengthy questions. And I hope we have you back on the show again. I would like everybody to check out this book, The Work of Living. Check out the Real News Network. I want to end with a quotation by Kyle, the Sheetwork Medal from Kentucky, from Max's book. Kyle surmised the importance of all workers. He says, I feel like a lot of people, working people, not just at our company and around the city, but all around the world, are seeing how important they really are to the grand scheme of things. You're not just a number. You're pretty important, actually. You make the money for these companies and you get the product out there. They know they need us to do work. Before the pandemic, workers might have disputes and the bosses would be like, well, if they want to go work for another company, go let them. But now they're like, oh, please stay. So thank you, Max, for a informative book that you've written. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did you know that you could donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI Radio and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling KKFI at 816-931-3122 and ask for the development director.
You can honor the legacy of Richard Tripp of Care of Poor People and save a life in the process. Here's how.
It's called Lug-A-Jug. First, fill up a clean jug or plastic bottle with water, then freeze it overnight, and finally, take it with you as you go about your normal business. When you see a homeless person, let them have the jug. It's a simple way to help folks get through this extreme heat.
This message is a public service announcement of 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
And we're back. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Mark Galis.
There once was a union maid who never was afraid of the goons and ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriffs who made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called, and when the company boys came round, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die. This union mate was wise to the tricks of company spies. She couldn't be fooled by company stools. She'd always organize the guys, always get her way. When she fought for higher pay, she'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say. Oh, you can scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
From the 1981 album Bread and Raises, Songs for Working Women, that was Bobby McGee with Union Maid. There are two ways for a union to become the exclusive bargaining representative for workers at a workplace. The most common way is for a union to win an election. The other way is for the employer to voluntarily recognize the union where the union shows majority support, typically through signed union authorization cards. As you might imagine, voluntary recognition is rare. An employer will almost universally insist that an election be held, irrespective of how many signed cards the union might possess. But it wasn't always like that. For most of the 1950s and 60s, employers were required to voluntarily recognize a union that had majority support, unless the employer had a good faith doubt about the union's declared majority status. This is known as the Joy Silk Doctrine, named after the 1949 NLRB case involving the Joy Silk Mills Company. Unfortunately, that all changed in 1969 in a United States Supreme Court case called NLRB versus Gissel Packing Company, where the court abandoned the good faith doubt standard. Even more unfortunate was the reason why. The NLRB's own associate general counsel, who argued before the court, completely misrepresented the board's position, and the court bought it. Now, more than 50 years later, the NLRB's general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, is looking for ways to revive the Joy Silk Doctrine and make it easier for a union to be recognized without an election. Ian Ward, contributing editor for Politico magazine, recently wrote a piece for Politico entitled "The Lie That Helped Kill the Labor Movement." He now joins us to discuss that provocatively titled article. Ian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with, what is the Joy Silk Doctrine?
So the Joy Silk Doctrine was a policy, an NLRB policy stemming from a 1949 case involving some textile workers at a textile factory in South Carolina. And what happened was that the workers had collected union authorization cards from a majority of their bargaining unit, a process known as card check, and presented the majority of the cards to their employer, who had denied union recognition on the basis of the card check. The workers appealed to the NLRB. And in its ruling, the NLRB laid out this policy, which came to be known as the Joy Silk Doctrine, according to which, in the absence of a, quote, good faith doubt about the union's majority status, employers were obligated to recognize the union as the workers' exclusive bargaining agent.
And at that point, if the employer didn't comply, then the board would issue a bargaining order ordering them to bargain with the union, right?
Yeah, that's correct. If they insisted on an election or simply refused to comply, in almost all, but not necessarily all cases, they would issue a bargaining order.
So what exactly is good faith doubt?
Yeah, I mean, it was a fairly capacious concept, right? And it became problematic later on, but at least initially, the Joy Silk Doctrine required the employer to demonstrate a good faith doubt in the form of independent knowledge that the cards had been forged or that there was coercion involved or something like that. And the burden, at least initially, rested on the employer to demonstrate a good faith doubt. Now, in 1966, I believe, the board amended its policy in a case called Aaron Brothers. And in that decision, it shifted the burden of demonstrating good faith from the employer to the board itself. So after that decision, in order to issue a bargaining order, the board's general counsel in trial had to show that the employer was not acting in good faith, which made it slightly more difficult for the NLRB to issue bargaining orders, but not impossible.
Well, a few years after that, 1969, the Supreme Court took up a case called Gissel Packing to consider or reconsider the Joy Silk Doctrine, and it didn't quite go like the board expected. Can you tell us, who was Dominic Manoli?
That's right. Dominic Manoli was an associate general counsel at the NLRB at the time, and he was responsible for representing the board's position in front of the court. When he appeared before the court, he was questioned by Justice Byron White, who posed a hypothetical to him, which was a hypothetical that had been floating around among labor lawyers and business community, which was, how would the board respond to an instance in which an employer, without saying anything about an absence of good faith or bad faith, simply declined to recognize a card check and asked for an election, insisted upon an election. And the NLRB's policy here was pretty clear. Even with the Aaron Brothers alteration, the Joy Silk Doctrine should have empowered the NLRB to issue a bargaining order in that sort of instance if the union asked for it or if the union petitioned them. But Manoli didn't say that. In fact, Manoli said, contrary to the arguments that the NLRB had laid out in its briefs, that the board had abandoned the so-called good faith test altogether and that employers could simply insist on an election, deny a card check without receiving a bargaining order from the board.
We actually have a clip of that exchange. This was an oral argument that took place on March 26, 1969. And we'll listen to this exchange between Justice White and Manoli, about what the employer could do when faced with authorization cards from the union. This clip is courtesy of the OEA website, and it runs about 2 minutes.
Well, Mr. Minnelli, what is the board's view of what the employer must, I don't like to say, what is the position that he must take before the board that will recognize that he may insist on an election rather than to accord recognition based on cards?
Your Honor, if a union goes to an employer and says to the employer, we have cards here from a majority of your employees which have designated us as, their bargain representative, the employer may say, the board has said this, that the employer may say, I don't like cards. I don't wish to rely upon your cards, and I do insist that you go to an election. I think that that's the proper way to resolve this question, this representation question, is to go to an election. If he does no more than that, he may even engage. I mean, during the pre-election period, he may engage in speech, make speeches to his employees.
But that may not get him. The union may just file 8A5 charges on him then.
The board the general counsel will not issue a complaint on the basis of that. In that kind of situation where the employer says to the union, I don't wish to rely upon cards.
Well, I don't care how many cards you've got. I don't care.
That's right. I don't care how many
he
cards
you've got. He can get an election then?
That's right.
That's your representation. That's what the position of the board is.
That's right. As long as he does not misbehave. Now, that's why, as I say.
As long as what?
He does not misbehave, does not engage in contemporaneously with his refusal to accept those cards, that he does not engage in unfair labor practice and serious unfair labor practice, because the board, in some cases where the employer may have engaged in some isolated unfair labor practice, it still will permit it to refuse to bargain with the union. It's only when engages in serious unfair labor practice.
It certainly doesn't emerge from your briefs in this case.
I hope it did.
Has this always been the practice?
No, Your Honor. I think the board has changed
a
little bit.
It's a long time since I've been at it, but the board has changed a little bit
in its approach to these cards here. I think
quite a bit.
Well, I have to say, Justice White seems rather incredulous at Minnelli's position.
Yeah, and he wasn't the only one. According to some eyewitness accounts that have been passed down, the labor lawyers who were in the room and the union representatives were totally confounded by Minnelli's about-face, and the lawyers representing the employers even asked for a transcript, sort of as a joke, to present in future cases because they were so surprised by what Minnelli had said.
Any idea why Minnelli took the position that he did, which was totally contrary to what was at that time board policy?
Yeah, no one knows for sure, actually. There are a couple of theories, and in 2005, actually, two law professors reviewed the case file and went back and interviewed people who had been at the trial, interviewed colleagues in Minnelli, and no one actually asked Minnelli. He had died in the 80s before anyone thought to revisit this. But there are a couple of theories. One is that the hypothetical presented was a sort of tricky one. There was a straightforward answer, but it's possible that Minnelli just got tripped up in the wording of the question, but that seems somewhat unlikely given that he was a well-versed lawyer and appearing in front of the Supreme Court. What the two law professors conclude is that he probably deliberately misstated the board's position because he thought that his reading of the policy was more sound legally, or on a more cynical reading, that he simply inserted his own policy preference and represented that as the board's opinion. The business community at the time was very opposed to the Joy Silk Doctrine, even in its modified form, and there's some evidence that he was getting an earful from the business community to try to overturn it. So no one knows for sure, but it does certainly seem like he deliberately misrepresented the position of the board.
I liked the quote you included in your article from Brian Petruska, general counsel for the Laborers Mid-Atlantic Regional Organizing. Quote, Minnelli chose to avoid being ensnared by this thicket with a simple denial that the thicket existed, end quote.
Yeah, exactly. That's the fact that the hypothetical was sort of difficult to avoid. And rather than acknowledging some ambiguity, he sort of plowed through it.
So when all was said and done, how did the Supreme Court resolve the issue in Gissel Packing?
Yeah, so they basically took him at his word and said, issued a decision saying that the NLRB had abandoned the Joy Silk good faith test and basically said that moving forward, the board would only issue bargaining orders in cases where there were egregious mispractice or on behalf of the employer. So it significantly raised the bar for issuing a bargaining order.
And so what's the practical problem with that? The
practical problem is that it makes it rather easy for employers to commit unfair labor practices, to dispel union support without being facing any sort of repercussion from the NLRB.
I think Justice White in his hypothetical was, I don't like these cards, so I don't have to bargain, right? Minoli said,
sure. Basically. Okay. Yeah, more or less. It basically opens the door for employers simply to, I mean, it's rendered card check completely obsolete, more or less. Basically, no card checks never result. They don't even use them anymore. I mean, it's become a practically obsolete practice after the Gissel decision.
Because God forbid should an employer voluntarily recognize a union.
Yeah. I mean, that's the dynamics of this, and they're taking the easiest way out, and that's the easiest way.
Well, more than 50 years have passed since Gissel Packing, and it still is the standard today. But the NLRB General Counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, who's appeared on this program before, wants to change that. What's the General Counsel said about a return to Joy Silk?
Yeah, so she, in her guidance after she assumed office, recommended returning to the original Joy Silk standard, and that's important. I mentioned earlier that the board had modified its position in 66, and that introduced the hypothetical that White was asking about. And Abruzzo, in order to avoid replicating this ambiguity, has recommended that the board return to the original Joy Silk standard, where the employer has to demonstrate a good faith doubt about the authenticity of the cards in order to reject them and insist on an election. And then she has subsequently filed a brief in a case before the court, or rather before the board, recommending that the board adopt this policy again. The board, as your listeners probably know, is three Democratic appointed members and two Republican appointed members, and they're expected to issue a decision on this sometime in the coming months. It could be the next few months, but more likely before the end of the year.
And that's a case called Cemex Construction Materials Pacific, in which the general counsel also, in addition to Joy Silk, is moving to outlaw captive audience meetings, which is an issue she discussed with us when she was on the program. We have a friendly board, union-friendly board, a union-friendly general counsel, a presidential administration that's friendly to labor. But we have courts, especially the Supreme Court, that are not exactly friendly to labor. So what's the future hold for Joy Silk?
Yeah, it's uncertain at this point. It's almost certain that if the board were to adopt or were to return to the Joy Silk doctrine, which is, if not a given, it seems likely based on the composition of the board, but it's not a guarantee, that it would be reviewed by the circuit courts, and who are, depending on which court it lands in, are not necessarily friendly to labor either. And then ultimately would likely be reviewed by the Supreme Court. Proponents of Joy Silk, who I spoke to, are not optimistic about its chances at the Supreme Court, given the current composition of the court and its history towards organized labor.
Well, pessimism is probably appropriate when it comes to the Supreme Court and how they view labor relations issues. In the time we have left, where can our listeners find your work?
Yeah, my work appears most frequently in Politico magazine, which is online. It's Politico's home for long-form narrative reporting and investigative work. I occasionally write for other places. I write a weekly newsletter called Southpaw Report, actually, which is left-wing commentary on the politics of sports, where we engage with some labor issues. In that, there's actually a big labor fight unfolding in Los Angeles, I believe, right now, where the workers at the Dodgers Stadium, which is hosting the MLB's upcoming All-Star Game, have threatened to go on strike and are negotiating with their employer for better working conditions. So that's another venue I'm working in, but mostly for Politico Next.
And where can listeners find that?
That's it. If you look up Southpaw Report, it's a newsletter on Substack. It's free. You can subscribe. It comes out on Sunday mornings.
Very good. Ian Ward, contributing editor for Politico Magazine, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Mark.
We meet to die in freedom's cause and raise our voices high. We'll join our hands in union strong to battle or to die. Hold the fort, for we are coming, union men, be strong. Side by side, keep pressing onward, victory will come. Look, my comrades, see the Union banner waving high. Reinforcements now appearing, victory is nigh. Hold the fort, for we are coming, Union men, be strong. Side by side, keep pressing onward, victory will come. See our numbers still increasing, hear the bugles blow. By our union we shall triumph over every foe. Hold the fort, for we are coming, union men, be strong. Side by side, keep pressing onward, victory will come. Fierce and long the battle rages, but we do not fear. Help will come whene'er it's needed, cheer my comrades, cheer. Hold the fort, for we are coming, union men, be strong. Side by side, keep pressing onward, victory will come.
That was Billy Bragg with Hold the Fort.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Know Your Rights. This is Mike Amash with the law firm of Blake & Euler. If at first you don't succeed in disenfranchising Missouri voters, try again. So seems to be the motto of the Missouri Republican Party. As many of you may be aware, in the most recent legislative session, the Missouri legislature passed, and Governor Parsons subsequently signed, a new voter law. We're going to discuss that new voter law this month in Know Your Rights, but significantly, I want to note that that new voter law does not go into effect until August 28th, and as a result, its provisions will not impact the upcoming Missouri primary, which is to be held on August 2nd. In passing its new voting law, Missouri Republicans seek to solve a problem which doesn't exist, a problem of falsification of voting and voting fraud and issues with tampering of voting machines. So what does the new voting law do? Significantly, once the new law goes into effect on August 28th, voters will need a government-issued photo ID in order to vote in Missouri. A state's driver's license, a passport, or a military ID are all valid options. All other forms of identification, including school IDs, utility bills, or bank statements, will no longer be accepted. Individuals who do not bring correct form of identification to the polls will be asked to fill out a provisional ballot and will have an opportunity to bring a photo ID back to the polls to make sure that their vote is counted. But again, they'll have to bring a photo ID back. In addition, the new law will prohibit touchscreen voting machines in 2024. While paper ballots are already overwhelmingly used in Missouri, Republicans have sought to scale back the use of electronic voting equipment, not just in Missouri, but nationwide, spreading falsehoods that the devices were rigged during the 2020 election. Another change that the bill will introduce is the new law will replace presidential primaries with political caucuses. Caucuses will be hosted entirely by political parties. And to note, I believe the last time Missouri held a caucus instead of a presidential primary was 2012. Now, in a small but important win, Missouri Democrats in the legislature were able to get a bill in related to absentee voting. Starting with the November election, any voter will be able to vote absentee 2 weeks before the election without needing a reason to qualify. Previously, a reason to qualify was necessary and a 6-week window was provided. And finally, the new law will allow the Missouri Secretary of State to audit voter rolls, thus further politicizing the role of the Secretary of State in the state's political system. So to summarize, the big takeaways is the new law will require voters to show a photo ID. The law will prohibit touchscreen voting machines after 2024, will allow the Missouri Secretary of State to audit voter rolls, gets rid of presidential primaries and replaces them with caucuses, and gives voters 2 weeks to vote absentee with no excuse before an election. Significantly, it should be noted that prior efforts to pass similar laws by the Missouri legislature have failed to pass legal muster and have fallen to legal challenges. Now, we can anticipate that there, once again, will be legal challenges to the current law that was put into effect by the Missouri Republicans. While many politicians are criticized for flip-flopping, we can credit Missouri Republicans here for being consistent. They consistently pass voting laws to try to disenfranchise Missouri voters. And who we disenfranchise, who Missouri Republicans disenfranchise, is consistent. Young voters, minority voters, and voters in urban areas. As I stated earlier, legal challenges to the new law will surely be mounted, and we'll see how the Missouri courts handle these new restrictions passed by Missouri Republicans. That's all the time we have this month on Know Your Rights. Once again, this has been Mike Amash with Blake and Ulig.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Our calendar is posted on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page if you want to grab some of the phone numbers or links on the internet. Canvassers, phone bankers needed for the No on Kansas Constitutional Amendment campaign now to August 1st. To volunteer, go to KansansForFreedom.com. 2022 Kansas Election Forum for all candidates from governor to judges, Saturday, July 23rd, 4 to 7 p.m., First Baptist Church, 500 Nebraska Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Poll watchers wanted for primaries on August 2nd. Various shifts, August 2nd, call your local party office. There's also going to be a canvas on Saturday, starting at IBEW Local 124 for several candidates. You can just show up at before 10 a.m. Solidarity for Climate Justice, Fighting for Our Lives, Saturday, August 6th, 4 p.m., Isles Davis Park, 1000 Locust Street, sponsored by Clean Air Now. You can find the rest of our calendar on our Facebook page. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our interviews are with Troublemakers, a report from the Labor Notes Conference. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Stephen Hill. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Stand Up, produced by the Racial Justice Initiative. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM. We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's
Mississippi. He said if I were Frank Sinatra, I'd pull strings. And through political pull, you'd be on top of the glorified garbage pile. With all of their plastic smiles, you'd be with all the self-appointed kings and queens, with all their power and wealth and the material things that symbolize the greed that's keeping the world in need. And you would be the darling of the Reagans and the Trump son, never to acknowledge the conditions where you've come from, to struggle